Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd.
Hey everybody, this is Jimmy Corrine, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. Our guest today is Bob Colhan, and he is the author of the new book, Getting to Yes And, The Art of Business Improv. I've known Bob since the 90s back here in Chicago. He is an incredible improviser and teacher, and I knew him when he was a core faculty member at the Second City Training Center and as one of the co-founders of the critically acclaimed improv musical Uber group Baby Wants Candy when they were performing at the I.O. We talked to Bob about what the effect Martin DeMott had on him. The early years of musical improv with Baby, that's what we used to call Baby Wants Candy, Baby, if you were in the know, and how he got into teaching businesses improv. You're going to really enjoy this episode. But before we get to that episode, I just want to say I'm back from vacation. I took last week off, so it's great to be back and doing the podcast. I'm not sure what our schedule is going to be for the next couple months. We may be doing the episodes every other week or something. I haven't figured that out yet. Also, I just want to say we're back from Florida. We went on a trip to Florida. We took Betsy, and it was very... it was a hard trip, and one of the hard trips that happened like on the third day there, I was sitting out on the porch, I think, out seeing the ocean, and all of a sudden I heard Lauren scream, and Betsy fell off the changing table. And I say changing table, but really what it was Lauren's mother had put a towel on top of the dryer that we were using to change Betsy's diapers. And so Betsy hit her head on the tile floor. And she was, I mean, it was scary. I was angry and sad, and I wanted to blame Lauren. And then, you know, Betsy was really shaken up for a couple days. And every time we changed her diaper, we no longer changed it on top of the dryer. That was out. We would change her on the floor or on the bed, and she still cried. And we called our OBGYN, who said, you know, just sleep with Betsy in the same room with her and just, you know, give her some extra love. And she's probably going to want to be, you know, be held by her mother a lot, which she was. And in a couple, 3 days or so, she was much, much better. I still think that I'm suffering from some trauma myself because it was really traumatic. But she's better now. There was no bumps on her head, nothing. And they tell me babies are resilient. And I want to say this. I really appreciate people being honest about having kids, or just for me at least. And somebody said to me about 3 or 4 months, and of course I was like, oh, no, that's never going to happen to my kid. They said, you know, something like this is going to happen. You're going to drop your kid, or she's going to fall off the changing table. And I'm glad that they told me that, because when this was all going down, I heard that person's voice in my head, and I'm like, okay, this is going to be all right. This is just what happens to parents. And Lauren talked to some other mothers who just said it was a rite of passage. So there it is, the parents. We have just made a rite of passage. So you're going to really love this episode. I love Bob Colhan. I've known him for a long time, like I said in the intro. He just has so much information. And he's just not only a great improviser, he's got a very specific voice. He's very physical. And he talks about how physicality and improv is important to him. But he's a great teacher as well. Here it is, the Bob Colhan episode. Enjoy. Bob Colhan, thank you for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Thank you so much for having me, Jimmy. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. You grew up in downstate Illinois, and you were into soccer, baseball, and cross country. But I also see, as I did some research, that you did tap dancing for 9 years. That's a long time. What did you love about tap dancing?
I grew up watching Lawrence Welk, essentially, and it was Bobby, and I can't remember the other, the dancers that he would dance with. But this, it was just so great, just almost gliding on air, and then you hear the little clicks take place. And I just always wanted to do it. So I got into it at a young age, and it really helped me a lot as a soccer goalie and as a shortstop in baseball. It was super quick on my feet, so it complemented the athletics.
And when you were a young improviser, you said you would go to I.O., the Annoyance, and Second City, and you'd watch your favorite teams over and over again. And when I read your book, Getting to Yes And, there's a sense that you are a student of comedy. And I think that today it's almost a lost art of people going to improv shows and watching them. But when I read your book and I did some research, you were really into that. How do you learn by watching?
Oh, well, I think it's such an important part of doing what we do. And I think you're right that now it's just so crowded that it's hard for students to have really the proximity, if nothing else, that we had growing up, where it was a much thinner community and we could just show up any night and sit down in the house, and the house would be half full or three quarters full, or sometimes it was full, which was, I think, rare in the early days of I.O. It's, you benefit so much from watching great performers do something that you care about and you want to be good at. You look at tricks of the trade. You look at what people actually do on a reoccurring basis that is part of their sort of comedy skill set, if you will. You look at people who are multi-tool players and what they do well. So you get the opportunity to study people who specialize in specific aspects of specifically improvisational comedy, as well as more broad stretching players. And from that, it informs who you are as a player, which you then practice in classrooms and, of course, practices and rehearsals, and then ultimately up on stage.
You know, one thing I remember about your sense of play and improvisation is there was a physical component to it. Where did you develop that skill?
You know, I was influenced pretty heavily early on by Martin DeMott, and he used to say, if you want to be good at this, you have to practice it. And he would call it pantomime, which I think made a lot of improvisers bristle. And to me, it was just like, oh, okay, pantomime, object work. If I want to create depth in my scene work, then I should learn how to give my scene work depth. And so I would just practice it. I'd practice it alone in my apartment. I would practice it in the shower. I'd pick objects up and put them down again and try not to move my hand in the slightest bit and pick them back up again. And in all honesty, Jimmy, it makes me really happy that that's something you remember about what I do, because I, in the spirit then of studying great players like Pete Holney or Bob Dassey as two very quick examples of great physical improvisers who give depth to their environment and characters through specificity and object work, I wanted to be one of those players.
And you talked about Martin DeMott. I was lucky enough to study with Martin at Columbia College, and really he's a huge influence on how I teach today. What did you learn from Martin that you still use today in your teaching?
Oh, so much. Martin, I was very fortunate as well. He was my first improv teacher as a 19-year-old, and then I actually ended up studying with him for 9 separate 8-week-long classes over my tenure, if you will, and he became my mentor. He informed so much of who I am as a person and also as an improv teacher. And his love of improvisation and his desire to have everybody do it, I think, is something that resonates throughout my body. And also his desire to communicate and communicate on an empathetic and personal level is something that's very important to me, especially in 2017, now, today.
Yes. Is there something practical? Like the one thing I got from Martin, the thing about Martin is when he would teach, he would give you little clues on how he was teaching. And one thing he shared with us that has stuck with me today is, you know what? When you guys start laughing and you start having a good time, especially at the beginning of class when you're doing warm-up games, that's when you know you can start to teach more complex or harder things like scene work. Was there a couple things that you got, or one thing that you got from Martin that you know you still apply today?
The desire to do right by my teammates is something that he really did ingrain in me at an early age, that to be a great improviser, you have to be a great team player and very supportive of the people around you. And when you go through the book, Getting to Yes And, you'll see actually several times I quote him, and several of the quotes that resonate with me and also as a fellow daddy of a very young child, I hope to pass on to my children are a couple of key elements. One is the phrase, you are pure potential. He said this quite often in classes, and that along with the I give you permission to fail phrase that he said quite often really helped a lot of improvisers get out of their head and play fearlessly and boldly and in the most polite way, unapologetically. One last phrase that he said that really continues to stay with me as a teacher of improvisation is the phrase, to be interested is to be interesting. And that shows how much emphasis he put on listening to, connecting with, engaging with, and caring about the people with whom he was communicating and giving them his undivided attention, even in a crowded room, so that that person feels special and feels like they're being heard and understood.
How would you apply that to that last thing you said? Don't worry about being interesting. Be interested. How would you apply that to how you perform as an improviser?
It's putting all the emphasis that you can and focus and concentration on what's happening in the moment rather than going inward toward what you can do and putting pressure on yourself to be clever, be creative, be funny. Don't be clever. Don't be creative. Don't be funny. Be present. Be in the moment at a high level. Listen to your fellow players. Watch your fellow players. Do whatever you can to support them. Be interested in what they're doing. And in doing so, they're going to give you that same respect and care.
So at 19, you moved to Chicago, you mentioned, and then I didn't know this. You talk about in this book, this great story where you get hired by Second City, your first paying job, I would imagine, in the business. And the gig is, if you could tell us a little about that story, you were at Taste of Chicago, which is our big summer food fest.
Yeah. Okay. So going back again to Martin, he announces to the class, the Second City has this job. If anybody's interested, let me know. He called it a mascot. No one wanted this. And I'm a 19-year-old and I'm literally sleeping on my cousin's floor on an ever deflating air mattress in an insanely hot Chicago summer. And he had no air conditioning and I'm broke as a joke. You know, I'm literally walking across the street to eat 35 cent 2-day-old Hostess cupcakes and pies to sustain my experience taking improv classes that summer. And so to make $5.50 an hour to me was almost like a handful of gold, and I would have done almost anything. And the show was called Winner Takes Oil, and it had a fabulous cast in it that included Michael McCarthy and Steve Carell with more than occasional Steve Colbert and Jill Talley, and just it was a great show. And they wanted me to dress up in this big plastic oil barrel and have no clothes, seemingly no clothes on, you know, have some shorts on and some shoes, and then essentially look naked with these tug of war ropes draped over my shoulder that would just cut into my skin and walk around the Taste of Chicago and hand out flyers to promote the show Winner Takes Oil. You know, on one, there was a big red barrel. On one side it said Second City, on the other side it said Winner Takes Oil. And I thought, okay, yeah, I can do this. And you learn very quickly that in that great festival, the Taste of Chicago, where there's several hundred thousand people, they start imbibing at a very early hour. And by the afternoon when I'm there, there's a lot of drunk people who decided to use this walking barrel as a trash receptacle. And they would just throw food at me and dump beer on me and down the bucket and just shake the barrel back and forth. And I'm a pretty skinny guy. I was a cross country runner and distance runner in track. So at 19, I think soaking wet, I was maybe like 150 pounds. And they would ping me back and forth like I was the pendulum in this clock and knock me over a couple of times. And I really, after one day of that, went back to the second city and said, you know what? I want to commit to this because I committed to it for you. I don't know that I can go back there and continue to get rope burns in my shoulders and get beat up by people, though. And I was able to yes and that a couple of different ways, including a small benefit of, you know, getting to see as many shows as I could, as long as there was room in the house or on the bench of Winter Takes Oil and the ETC show at that time. And, yeah, got to actually, they yes anded me and said I could put the barrel down to the side and I could just stand there and essentially sideshow Barker hawk the show for him.
Was Second City a goal of yours?
Yeah. That's a great question. It never was an overriding goal. I think there was certainly a time that I really wanted it. And when most of my friends were going down that path onto tour co's and onto the stages, I would lie if I didn't say that I wasn't envious of that. At the same time, Martin opened up a lot of doors for me in the Second City Training Center. And so while they were going down the path of auditions and getting on Blue Co and all the different co's and touring around, I was inside the classroom working hard, at first teaching three or four classes every term, and then had the opportunity to become one of the first core faculty with Lily Francis and Brian Posen. And we gutted the Second City Training Center under Ann Libra and put it back together again. And then I worked with Jack Bronis and Michael Gelman, gutting the IFA program, putting it back together again. So I had absolutely fabulous opportunities to work with that fantastic institution, the Second City, and eventually became a performer for them. When I left Chicago in 2009, I was an understudy on the Main Drain. I was Joe Canale's understudy, and I worked with the Second City actually on their cruise ships, where I eventually met my current wife, and now we have a couple of children. So she was a dancer on the cruise ships, and I was a Second City actor. And you know, the Second City, though it wasn't a drive necessarily always to be on the main stage full time, it provided me a lot of opportunities, and for that, I'll be grateful always.
And you know, it was interesting because we taught at the Second City around that time. And I think things were starting to change, because when I started out, if you said, and I've said this a million times on the podcast, so if you're listening, excuse me, but when I was starting out, if you wanted to be a teacher or a director of improv, that, you know, you got a little shit for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's a beef that I actually have, that a lot of great improvisers look at teaching almost as a default. That if other things fall through, I'll just go and start teaching. And we both know, in fact, probably everybody listening knows, that there's great performers who really can't teach, not only because they don't want to teach and they don't care about it, they just, it's not something they're focusing on. And so they're not really good at it. Similarly, there are some great teachers who don't perform. And we'll look back to Martin DeMont for that. He only got on stage one time that I knew him, and I twisted his arm to get him up on stage. And not to say that he never, ever got on stage. It just was just so rare that he did. So I think mistakenly people, when we were going through it, Jimmy, you and me teaching there, looked at teaching improvisation with, I think, a little bit of snobbery. And that's incorrect. Without great teachers, I'd roll the dice to say there'd be a lot less great performers.
For me, it was always less than. Like, I wasn't good enough because I didn't get a touring company or one of the stages. And the other thing that I've learned is, and I've been teaching for a long time, is it takes a while. I mean, it's taken me probably 20 years to really just get good at it. When did you start to realize, you know what, I'm really a good teacher?
I don't know. That's up to me to really say that I'm a good or bad teacher. I'm fortunate that there's a lot of students who have given me pretty fair marks and rankings. I'll tell you, once again, I think this might turn into the Martin DeMott show, because we both knew him and cared for him. He instilled the desire to teach in me so much, even though I worked with him only a couple of months in that summer intensive and didn't even complete the summer intensive at the Players Workshop of the Second City before I had to go back to college. When I went back to college at Illinois State, I started workshopping teaching it. And I'd send Martin, at that time, of course, there's no emails in 91, So I'm sending him postcards on how to teach. And of course, he tells me about the Viola Spolin book. And so I'm reading that, and we communicate back and forth. And he's giving me coaching notes via postcards that I still have on how to teach. So I've wanted to communicate this art form ever since I really started studying this art form. And hopefully I do it in a way that represents the people who taught me, represents the art form, and can teach the people who want to learn how to do it for themselves so that they can do whatever they want to do with it.
What excited you about teaching improv when you first started?
One of it was really just getting other people kind of jazzed up about this thing that I loved. A benefit, though, or at least a tangential point to it, though, was that once the students, especially if you resonated with them, liked what you were saying, they would come and watch your shows and essentially hold you accountable for the things that you were teaching them. And so it was a great way for me to keep my skill set as sharp as possible and the details of that skill set in line, because once you get students fired up and they start asking you why you did something that you're telling them not to do, you really have to have a solid answer. And because of those things, as well as the fact that once you start teaching, you hear and you hear the words come out of your mouth, you really start to find authentic ways to communicate what you love so much. And that then better informs you as a performer as well. That combination of those three things, I think, really continue to create a love and desire to teach in me.
And also, you were a founding member of Baby Wants Candy. And today, you know, we think of musical improv, it's such a big thing. But back then in the 90s, nobody here in Chicago was doing musical improv that I am aware of. What was that like? Take us back to being in Baby Wants Candy, the first couple shows.
Oh, wow. Okay. So in all fairness, Baby Wants Candy was founded as a group before I was on it. I did some bits with Monster Island at the same time Baby Wants Candy was formed. And about 6 months into their life, they asked me to join. And Scott Robinson was their director. And so I said, yeah, of course, you guys are brilliant. And he's brilliant. So I'm definitely going to do that. And we went through a few forms in early 1997 before we got to the musical. And the major reason we did the musical was because a great musical pianist was leaving. Dave Adler was leaving I.O. and we wanted to celebrate him. And so we had a couple of months with him still there. So we said, how about we do this form? And the group Baby Wants Candy and the people on it in 1996, 1997, and actually, you know, throughout, have always been super talented and super intelligent. And you take that combination and you put a gimmicky form like a musical to it, and then you have a great musician as well. You just have great talent, great intelligence, and a little bit of gimmick. And then all of a sudden you take that gimmick and it turns into a device, and the device turns into a form, and then you blow it up. And we were doing really well in 97, 98. And then we went to Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 1998 and did 30 shows in 24 days. And that was the moment that everything came together in a very real way, that we recognized, especially in Edinburgh, we were getting standing ovation after standing ovation and five-star review after five-star review in a festival that we were told that we were going to fail in and it's next to impossible to sell out. We were selling 3 days out, 3 days in advance. We came back like we were ready to take on the world. And then we went on a run at I.O. that was in the history of great teams, it should rank up there as one of those, that it was just multi-year, come and get it. We were going to bring the heat every single time we stepped on stage. And it was one of the best overall experiences, because we also had great players wanting to play with us. You know, it wasn't just this core group that was so insular that we didn't have it open to everybody. We had babies getting drafted over. I'll go to Blue Co. again. That was Baby Co. at Second City. So we would lose great talent to go tour in the monstership of improv and sketch comedy, the Second City. And we're this essentially renegade group at the Improv Olympic, or I.O. now. And once some people would go off tour and others would immediately jump in and take their place. And so it was a who's who of great talent doing musical improv in the late 90s.
You know, I don't think we've ever talked about this. What was the actual form? Now, I understand you were improvising a musical, but was there an actual structure, the nuts and bolts to it?
Well, back in at that time, there really was no formula for it like there is now in so many classes. And so what we did was, of course, rehearse. Every great improv team practices and rehearses. And part of our rehearsal process was to watch musicals. And we'd watch them independently, and we'd watch them together, and we'd talk about it and deconstruct it and talk about songs and forms. And the people who were directing us at that time were not musical theater majors, or even half, most of the time, theater majors. They were just great improvisers. And so what we were really focusing on is doing great improvisation inside the form, the musical. And so our form really was get everybody together at the top of the show for a group opening, run like crazy throughout the entire, we were fortunate to do 60-minute blocks, so 55 minutes of running like crazy, get everybody together at the end for a closing. That was the musical to us. And then because we studied it so passionately, we were able to throw in all sorts of musical devices like group numbers and 11th hour songs or long songs, I wish songs. And then because we were great improvisers, we were able to throw in all sorts of devices like split scenes and revolving doors or time dashes. And it was just kind of this just wonderful bring it if you can mess that came together in the most ridiculous ways.
When I've seen Baby Wants Candy back then, there was a sense of like the yes and was almost heightened.
Yes. It's because it's so ridiculous, right? So that you and I, Jimmy, we're in a scene together, and then all of a sudden the emotion swells to some point that you can no longer contain this dialogue. It has to come out in song. That alone is ridiculous. And then Baby just had the most insane senses of humor on the team. So we would go off into the fantastic, unicorns dry humping whales and whatever it might be, and make that part of the song. And the more we would commit to that, the more it became a reality for us. And the more it became a reality for us, the more it became a reality for the audience. And so that heightened state of yes and really is that anything goes, and whatever goes is real to us. And we're just going to continue to commit to this forever.
And the other thing is, you guys weren't that great of singers. And I think today people are, I know I still am, intimidated by musical improv. So what can we learn that you guys weren't the best singers?
That's true. It's true. I mean, we did have some really great singers, like, Rebecca Allen, for example, Sage Allen just jumping up, or Mary McCain. Most of us, though, were just great improvisers, or, I'm fortunate to have played with great improvisers. So hopefully I'm close to that bracket. I think that's all about commitment. Once again, in that heightened state of yes and that you just threw out there, the more you commit to it, the more the audience is going to forgive you. So if you don't have the best voice, I would say that I'm in that middle bracket. I certainly didn't have a brilliant voice, though sometimes I sounded better than others. And I didn't have the worst voice. I would just commit to these songs like they were the most important thing. And when it was time to put on that spine, that character, the emotion, I would commit to that as well. And of course, as mentioned before, I had some object work, so it added depth. And when you have that type of overall commitment on a singular basis, let alone a small group, one or two people in a scene, or the larger group, 8-10 people actually doing this musical form, the audience just comes right along with you. And so they forgive you for not being a great singer. In fact, they don't care as long as you're, bringing it.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. The other thing, you compare it to object work. I notice a lot of students are very self-conscious about their object work.
Yeah, I think because it's what a lot of people will start paying attention to. So if you don't do good object work, it can actually upstage the scene. And if you do great object work, it can upstage the scene as well. So I always looked at object work the same way I would look at props or objects as an actor, which is that's an extension of you as a performer and certainly of you as a character. And so it should complement, support what's already going on. And if that's intimidating, I would say fear, you know, either follow the fear, let's go the Del Close way, or just forget about the fear, you know, fail with glory. Just go out there and just continue to try until you are competent and pass the competence, good at it and solid at it. And improv is full of failure. It's full of failure across the board. And so if that's what you're worried about, that's going to actually resonate through probably the rest of your scene work anyway. So kick it to the curb and go play and have fun.
You know, the other thing is, as I was researching you, you were on Monster Island. I was on Monster Island. And I don't remember playing with you. Were we on different times or was I just blacked out? I don't know.
No, you know, I was like a second or third addition to Monster Island. So we did actually play together, and it doesn't at all surprise me or even insult me at all that you don't remember, because for all practical purposes, I was a newbie. You know, I was just about a year into it when I got pulled into Monster Island. And because of that, I wasn't as well known or recognized as the other great players on that team. You know, I mean, that was an all-star team, and I was extremely fortunate to get drafted to play with them. And, you know, I guess you and me now, 21 years, 20 years later, I could say, I don't know why I was drafted. I didn't question it though. They wanted me to play.
Do you remember who asked you to play?
Matt gave me a call to play. Matt Dwyer.
Okay.
Who I think was running Monster Island.
I think it was Matt and Noah Gregoropoulos and Rich Fulcher.
Mm-hmm. Fulcher.
Arthie was
Tallarico was on it.
Stephanie was on
Kowski. Stephanie was on the original Baby Wants Candy. So the way I remember it, Monster Island was formed. It was an all-star group, and Baby was formed as an all-star group. And there's a debate which one came first. There was like Stephanie and Peter Gwynn over, and a good handful of other brilliant players, of course, over on Baby Wants Candy. And then you had like Tallarico and Fulcher and Dwyer and a lot of great players over on Monster Island. So you had these two camps of all-stars. And I started with Monster Island, though Monster Island was a relatively short-lived team in the overall scheme of things. And as Monster Island seemed to be, you know, falling apart a little bit, that's when I got drafted over to Baby.
And, you know, when they write the book about Baby Wants Candy, I hope they come to speak to me, because I was on that original team. This is before it was became a musical group. And we would rehearse at the Damon, which was a bar in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. With Rob Mello?
Rob Mello. And then the show Naked that I did with Stephanie Ware, which was a mm-hmm. two-person, you know, one-hour scene.
Great show.
I believe
great
came
show.
Out of working with Baby Wants Candy. So I just want the historian, and I know, you know, you're close to the Baby Wants Candy, which is now a corporation, I believe, because they've got groups on New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. I hope they come and talk to me. I know you have some influence there.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? I am a huge fan of and student of improv and improv history. And I would call right away like Don Bardwell up.
You know? Yeah, Don was on that too. Yeah.
Yeah. And so many others. And I'm a little embarrassed that I can't name everybody on the original Baby team. But like I said, somewhere in the first original Baby was formed in 96. And by the end of 96, I was drafted on. And I could tell you, you know, easily who was on that group, because we started doing the documentary. That was the first form we started, and did that a couple of like messy forms, and then started doing the musical in fall of 97. So yeah, I missed the first draft of Baby. I was playing with Monster, and fortunately got the second draft of Baby.
I just want you to give me my blessings that I can say I was a founding member of Baby.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I also, yes. Okay, so let's...
Without you, I wouldn't be a founding member of the LLC. So that's the extension of it.
Great. And I'm going to tell people when they come to interview me about it, that you actually replaced me in Baby Wants Candy. So let's just get our story straight now.
There was a rumor. This might be actually a debate. Okay. So we'll straighten. I'll commit to you right now. I think the rumor was I replaced Charles Glenn, actually.
Okay.
So I'm going to say you and I are aligned right now. Only you and I know about this. So we'll go headstrong into the public saying that I replaced you.
Right. And then I got into a fight with Charles Glenn. We got to have some juiciness around it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. It was a horrible fight. In the end, though, it made your relationship stronger.
Yes. And I think it made the group stronger, as I remember.
Absolutely. When both of you guys were out of it.
Yes, it did. And that's, and you know, because of that, I think this is going to all be in the book. I was holding the group back about music because I was like, I don't want to do music. I don't think people will get it. It's a gimmick. And, you know, I'm here to say you guys were right and I was wrong. Well, 20 years and a lot of therapy to get to this point, but I'm going to admit it, Bob. I was wrong.
You know, that's I feel like I'm in the presence of greatness because of that. The humility and the intelligence.
Now, you have made a living for many years teaching improv for businesses. Yes. And how you got this, to me, almost seems like you were using some improv skills to get it.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, so much – there's – an irony, at least when I was really in the thick of it at I.O., that people would really teach the tenets of improvisation in the classroom and certainly perform them up on stage. And then as soon as we'd get off stage, there'd be all sorts of, in some ways, you know, bad, you know, backstabbing and talking behind others' backs. And in other cases, just sort of ignorance of the fact that these rules for improvisation should be applied on stage as well as off stage, or off stage as well as on stage. And mine was a very serendipitous encounter with somebody who was on sabbatical from Duke Fuqua School of Business, and they were looking for an experiential learning program. And he actually tried to pass it off to a couple other teachers, which this part isn't in the book, and they all said no. And somehow he got to me, and I said, yeah, I could absolutely do this. And so after passing it through some channels and nobody else really wanting it, I jumped at it and was able to work with him for years and work with a lot of great behavioral psychologists and cognitive psychologists from Duke and Columbia Business School and UCLA, which allowed me to put some depth into how I understand we make decisions on an individual basis, in a group, and then how the group makes the decisions. And that allowed me to create some great programs. So it really was about being in the right place at the right time. And that's that serendipitous thing. And then in the spirit of improv, yes, anding it, taking advantage of it, working hard, making initiations and declarations, and then backing off and adapting along the way to drive this to be a successful business.
And when you go into a company, and I've done corporate improv and for businesses and stuff like that, you don't have the same buy-in as when they sign up at, say, I.O. or the UCB to take classes. How do you get people who are not performers comfortable enough to start opening up?
You know, I have had such a wonderful 10-year teaching people who want to be on Saturday Night Live and want to be on The Daily Show and want to be on Second City Main Stage or on IO House Team or Annoyance House Team. The impetus is completely different when you start looking at people who are in business. They don't want to be on Saturday Night Live. They don't want to be on any of the touring companies. What they want to do is understand how to apply it to their jobs. And so my focus was and still is, as it is in the book in TS and, how to maintain the integrity of this art that we love and communicate it to people who are from a different world and want to use it in a different way. And so that actually starts with my approach in the classroom as well. Understanding my audience, you know your audience, and doing whatever you can to communicate why this is such a great art form to them. And those differences then become, in the spirit of improv, reasons to celebrate. You celebrate the differences and play to those differences, not placate those differences. Just understand the audience and make sure that you are doing the best you can for that audience. And so,
in a practical way, how would you start a workshop for business people versus how you would start a workshop, say, if you were teaching at Second City?
Well, if I was I think the level of research, it starts there. Because of my improv background, I think I could go into pretty much, you know, you could tag me right now and say, Bob, can you sub my class? We're working on an acting. I really need them to walk out of the classroom with a strong understanding of that character work comes from an inner place. And so you show that through your spine and through your face, your mask, and your, and you have to still develop relationships and scene work. I could walk in that classroom right now and do that without a lesson plan laid out. Whereas in a business classroom, I really take the research approach and try the best I can to understand what their challenges are and what, who's coming to the table and what the desired outcomes are. And so it really starts with that type of homework, that due diligence, so that once I finally get in the classroom and say, okay, everybody, we're going to start doing some improvisation, I'm in a better place to succeed than I would be if I just came in cold and said, okay, let's do art. Because the pure art side, by the way, it's not that it's easy to teach improvisation. I don't think it is at all. I think, though, art is messy, and so there's much more leeway, much more forgiveness even inside an improv classroom as it drives toward comedy or an art form than it is in business, where they want a return on investment.
And you bring this up in the book when you say, as we know in improv, there are no mistakes. How do you adapt that when you're in business culture?
So that phrase, there are no mistakes, of course, in improvisation means an awful lot because that relates to the you are pure potential and follow the fear and be bold, fail with glory, that whole aspect of it's not a mistake on an improv stage as long as you recognize what happened and in some way react to it, right? But your pure reaction to somebody walking through an improv table that you just took a minute to set up is justification enough that they walk through the table. You don't need to call somebody out and say, you just walk through my table. You know, that's going to alienate them and alienate the audience likely. And then you're going to spend the rest of the scene trying to dig yourself out of that call out, as opposed to just go over, pick up the table, set it up again, patiently, diligently. And then when somebody else walks over, don't even mention a word, just go pick it up again and do the same thing. That's going to create laughter from the audience because you're respecting the environment and showing that there are no mistakes. That wasn't a mistake they walked through the table. That's a gift. That's an opportunity. Now, in business, though, that doesn't have the same resonation. You can't just go through a business and be like, there are no mistakes, because there are, in fact, mistakes that could cost people money or their jobs or could injure people depending on the specific field. So for me, that phrase, there are no mistakes, has to be put within some kind of time restraints. So for, let's say, a block of time, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, an hour, we're going to get together, we're going to collaborate, we are going to use the tenets of improvisation to be creative, to brainstorm with each other, and we're not going to worry about the right answer. Say the wrong answers, fail early, fail often. This is where I think there are no mistakes, in that brainstorming, very creative process. Once you start taking the creative process, though, and reducing it down to a viable outcome, a product or an ultimate process or service that you're going to provide, that's really where the editing takes place. And this is where I think a lot of improvisers kind of blur the line incorrectly when they're teaching improvisation to corporate people. And I'll put it to you this way. Jimmy, I know you have created a number of one-man shows, and in that creation process, there's a point where you're just sort of brain dumping, right? You're getting it out of your head. You're making a mess. You're doing drafts of the work over and over. And then you get it up on stage. You workshop it a little bit. You get a director. You learn. You coach. You come back together. You put a second draft in a place or a third draft in a place. So this is these two styles of thought that I'm talking about. That brainstorming process is where you just get it out of your head. That's that divergent thinking versus the convergent thinking, where you start workshopping it and you start judging it. You start getting some coaches in there. You fine-tune it, you workshop it again, you recraft it, you edit it out. And that's that point then in business that needs to have that line less blurry as well, from that pure brainstorming process to the, I have to clean this up and this has to turn into a marketing campaign or whatever it might be, as the final outcome for you was a show, and for me was a show as well, or multiple shows. For them, it's a product or process or campaign. And the mistake that a lot of people make is that we start thinking about the mistakes while we're just trying to create. And it's much more important to create that level open playing field in which people are not afraid to fail and not afraid to make mistakes. And that's where the genius is lying in wait.
And the other thing you talk about in this book is, and it's something that I've experienced not only when I'm teaching in businesses, but I'm also teaching a regular class, usually a first level class, is this fear. Like fear is there in the room. And how do you teach somebody, how do you, Bob, make somebody less afraid or make them braver?
Okay, so this goes back to the previous question I think that you asked. So I'm going to hit this one, I think, a little more on the head, which is to address it. You know, go in and I literally ask, who's anxious? Who's a little nervous about this? Raise your hand. Great. Now we look around. See, I literally say, turn your left, turn your right, see who's in the same boat with you. Okay, now who's done improv before? Raise your hand. And, you know, the majority of people will raise their hand that they're nervous or anxious about getting into improv. And the minority, usually the extreme minority, if anybody at all, raises their hand and taken some improv classes before. So in doing this, what I show people is that we're all in the same boat. We're all doing this together. We are all literally equal. So let's take that anxiety, that nervousness, that fear and say, that's okay. It's okay to have this. Now let's just put it to the side. Let's see if we can look at fear or nervousness or anxiety as energy. And if it's energy, then how can we redirect this energy to a more productive path, to a more productive output? And what we need to do is understand that even by looking at each other and recognizing that this number of people are anxious and this few number of people have improv experience and we are all equal, we can channel our energy together toward a common purpose. And that takes that energy that most people, when they're nervous or anxious, would turn inward toward fear and redirects it outward toward each other and toward the workshop itself.
So taking that concept, what would you tell somebody who is about to do a show and they are terrified? They're about to go and do a class and they're terrified and they're not working and set up a structure like you've created in your classes?
I would say that I would say almost the same thing I just said, that, you know, if you're nervous or even terrified, it's okay. That's great. That's nerves. Let's start moving around a little bit. Let's get our, that's something a little different. Let's get our blood pump a little bit. Let's get moving around a little bit. Let's get out of our heads, because normally when people are nervous, they start thinking, right? Oh, I'm so nervous. I'm so anxious. Oh, I'm sweating. I hope I remember this. And so they're caught in their heads. And if you take that energy that you would turn into yourself and redirect it out, if theoretically anyway, these people are not performing alone on stage, so who else can you make eye contact? Who can you kind of shake a mates with or rub each other's backs or, you know, just be around other nervous energy? Just stay loose, focus on staying loose. Then that's usually enough to table it until they get up on stage and they can blow it up. Because once they get on stage, that ball is rolling. And most people are not going to stop that ball from rolling, especially if they've been trained properly, just a yes and, yes, yes, yes and, embrace what's happening, react, adapt, have fun. Then they're off and running and they blink twice and the show's done. And they're in that euphoric state where they don't really know what happened. They just love the fact that it happened. And hopefully they're not looking at a tape of it and they just feel good about it in the future, because the tapes, you know, don't capture the spontaneity and the audience reaction as well as memory does.
Is it important for them to come in if they are nervous, like they would be in one of your workshops, and admit to somebody in the cast that they're afraid that night?
Yeah, sure. Why not? I mean, if we really have done our jobs as teachers and set the class up to unconditionally support each other and get each other's backs and go out of our way to make each other look good, then when one person's nervous, everybody should embrace that nervousness and embrace that person. And if one person's angry, everybody should do the same thing. If, you know, we all get caught in our head for different reasons at different times, right? I mean, no matter how good you are at this or how long you've been doing it, there are times that life just kicks you in the balls and it hurts and you still have to get out of your head and perform a show. And if you have a great group of people around you that you can be honest and say, guys, this was a rough day, and they give you a hug or you get into some, you know, game of Big Booty or George or whatever it is that helps you loosen your inhibitions and get out of your head, then you understand that you're not doing this alone and you're in with a lot of people. And then that strength in numbers actually turns into conformity pressure as well. And you get sucked into the happiness and joy that improvisation brings, as opposed to potential misery and despair or frustration that being alone brings.
I think that people think like, someone like you who've been doing it since the 90s, doing it a very long time, that, someone like Bob doesn't get nervous when he performs. Someone like Bob doesn't get nervous when he goes and teaches a workshop.
I was nervous teaching a workshop. Now, this is where I think a lot of people don't get so nervous, because like, I own this, I do this. I was teaching for... I didn't sign any paper, so I could say this, the DOD and
what's the people,
the Department of Defense.
Okay.
I can't tell you too much of anything just in case of anything. Sure. So what I'll tell you is that the audience was no joke. I mean, across the board, you want stars or you want stripes attached to a lapel or impressive, you know, people that you've seen on TV, and what they deal with is very real stuff with dire outcomes and, you know, protection, Department of Defense. I mean, the name says it all. And I had 2 hours, 2 hours from top to bottom, not a minute more. And I had to be on point 100% of the time, could not make any mistakes, and the return on investment had to be real. So the audience was high caliber and the stakes were incredibly high. And I was certainly nervous before that gig. So what do? When I get nervous, I get up, I pace, and I'm in the back, you know, there's another lecturer going on right before me. So I'm following them sitting down, by the way, for like 4 hours or something like that. So their energy is not at a great place. I get them at the end of the day too, right before dinner. So it's me and then dinner. So they're ready for a siesta, really, for all practical purposes. And I pace. I start moving around. You know, when I was a competitive runner, only in high school, still, I used to like just squeeze my hands into really tight fists as a way for me to like start channeling my energy from nervousness through my hands to my head, really. And I just focus that out and just start breathing and pacing and squeezing my hands. And all I keep thinking, I can remember vividly, this was just last year, as I'm pacing in the back of the house while somebody else is lecturing, is, let me have it. I want my turn. And that which was nervous energy was not nervous because I thought I was going to go out there and fail, because I really do embrace the idea of failing with glory. If I'm going to do it, you're going to watch me. If I'm going to fail, you're going to watch me try as hard as I can, not to fail, to succeed. And that doesn't mean waffle, and that doesn't mean scratch at the surface, you know, claw for air. That just means I'm just going to stay the course. I'm just going to do the best I can for the integrity of my art form and the audience that I have. And that's going to be it. I can walk out with my head high. And if I fail, I failed not from falling apart. I failed because I tried. And so that energy, which I have, turns into focus, and it turns into a desire to get out there and do my best. And that's the same on stage too. It happens sometimes, you know, the stakes are pretty high. Very, very, very excited times. You know, the, I owe 25th anniversary. Remember this one?
Yes.
Somehow seems to have been brushed under the rug as a successful event, which was, I think everybody who was there would say politely, was a challenged event. I was nervous before that gig. Baby was supposed to go up like third or fourth. And then, of course, the microphones aren't working, right? And then you have 20 minutes of sort of scrambling to get handheld mics, and or maybe more than that, you know, that famous picture with you and Mason. And I want to say Andy Dick and Mike Myers dancing together, you know, working to fill the air in whatever way we can, or fill the stage time, which whatever way we can, as we're working through tech difficulties. And Dave Koechner calls out, I think Baby Wants Candy's going to come out and do something. Anything that was, you know, would have been nervous getting up to the gig was, of course, tabled because of the debacle that was happening with the sound. And then the being thrust into line, like we had like 5 minutes maybe to huddle up as a team, shake a mates and be like, okay, we have two handheld microphones. We have a full band. Let's just go do the best we can. And then Baby went out there and just, you know, did what we do. And so I think nerves are okay. Nerves are good. It's part of who we are. It's, you know, what can you do for yourself to get you in that place that you're ready to do everything you can to succeed?
Well, you know, it's interesting stuff that, you know, in that case, they didn't, I believe they didn't do a sound check, right? Was that?
Yep, that's correct.
And so when they got out there, the stage was supposed to be mic'd and it wasn't mic'd. And then we had to start, you know, bailing water and getting handheld mics and setting mic stands up to try to make them work. And the thing I've always found interesting about that was, I don't know if you felt this way, I'd be, you know, when something like that goes awry, that in a lot of ways we remember that story, but also we feel closer to the people that were in war with us.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think all of us have that kinsmanship, that sort of fellowship that we already had because of improv. And yet I think if you got all of the people who were in that show together in one room, or as many as you could, and said, tell me about that night, you would get that sort of, I know the improv game is called Zeno's Paradox. It's, you know, everybody looks at a car accident from different angles on one 4- or 5-way intersection. And so they just see, you know, the one group sees the mailman delivering mail and then run out of the way. And somebody else from a different angle sees the baker looking out the window, and somebody else sees a couple kissing, and, you know, you just all describe the accident from these different angles. I think you would hear some really incredible stories based on the perspective and perception of the people who are in that group. And that will always create a bond.
And do you think, you know, as I'm thinking out loud here, so excuse me, but it almost seems like for a team, you know, like the, you know, you can rehearse and rehearse and rehearse, which I believe is really important and is also kind of a lost art, people, because they're doing so many shows. But the bombing and failing as a group seems to be a great way to be more cohesive as a team.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And for the record, I think if you're not rehearsing, you are doing a disservice to your own potential. Like, you got to just do it through reps, through chop, and get your chops up rather through reps. And you need a coach. And it's not just the stage time. Stage time's a great teacher. However, you should be failing 10 times more often in the rehearsals than on stage. And if you're failing 10 times more often on stage in a rehearsal, you're not rehearsing enough, so that when you get up on stage, you're that much better. And frankly, the bombing and failed shows can galvanize you. And I'll go back to Baby Wants Candy, if I can go on a quick tangent. There was a gig we did in, I think it was WIT, the Washington Improv Festival, like 10 years or more ago. And we did back-to-back shows. And the first show, we didn't really warm up properly. We weren't really connected. And the show, at best, was mediocre. And by that, I don't mean mediocre for Baby standards, because mediocre for Baby standards, especially in our prime, was like an A show for almost every other group, or many, many other groups out there. It was just a mediocre show. And we had to take a train ride from that first gig to the second gig. And all of us on that train were looking at each other, and we get these like little one-off conversations of this, we got to clean this up. Let's get refocused, everybody. Let's get out there and let's warm up properly. Let's just drive this thing. And that second show, we killed it. It was a like jaw-dropping, phenomenal, properly deserved standing ovation show that concluded with Thomas Middleditch jumping or doing a trust fall off of like 15-plus foot dock that was part of this stage that you weren't supposed to climb on. And he did, and all of us were underneath him, like essentially breaking the fourth wall toward Thomas, being like, no, we will catch you. We, you know, we weren't characters anymore. Like, you do this, we're going to catch you. And you know, that is exactly what you're talking about. That failed show pulled us together and made us pull up our bootstraps and say, this isn't what we do and this isn't who we are. Let's go do it. And we did that second show in a completely different way, and it showed.
What was the adjustment that you made between the bad show and then the good show? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think the adjustment started with that. You know, after the show, you feel it. Like, you feel like, oh, that wasn't good at all. And then we took that train ride, and we didn't, you know, all sit in separate cars. We didn't not talk to each other. Nobody pointed fingers at each other. You know, that's a key thing when failure comes. It's, you know, easy to blame one person. Point the finger first at yourself, and then let's all come together and see what we're going to do differently. And I don't know that everybody was pointing their finger at themselves. I would think they were, because we all do that. You know, I think all good performers look at themselves and say, what could I have done differently? And then we start connecting with the other people and make eye contact with each other and let everybody know that we're in this together and set some, you know, proper goals for the show, saying we are going to go do this. Let's go warm up. And I think all of that comes together as the readjustment that you're mentioning that helps you recover from a bad show to a good show.
We've got to wrap this up, as I can hear one of your children's.
That's my 4-month-old daughter.
Yes. Congratulations, by the way.
Hey, back at you.
Yeah. How are you doing with the sleep?
Oh, I have a 3-year-old son who just recovered from an ear infection, 2 bouts of pink eye, and the flu in 1 bout. And a 4-month-old daughter, who's yesterday was her 4-month birthday, and a book launch. I don't sleep, Jimmy.
I don't even know what sleep is anymore.
Well, you are.
How are you doing?
Anyone who has more than one kid, and we're not young people. I'm 52, first time dad, and you
I'm
had
45.
Your
45.
Yeah. Yeah. We're not. I'm not young.
I'm not. We're 7 years apart from each other. If you're not young, I'm not.
I have really found, like, having improv training, especially with the that there are no mistakes. Like, my wife will freak out. Like, if Betsy, my daughter, is in the crib too long, and she's like, oh, we left her in the crib too long. And I'm like, okay, we're going to make mistakes. There are no mistakes. We just learn and move on. What have you learned in terms of improv that's made you a better father?
I think it's right. You know, it's cut from, if not that same cloth, it's cut with the same scissors from a very similar cloth. And that's just the adaptability aspect of it, that, okay, if that didn't work out, then let's just keep yes-anding this until we get to something that's workable and doable. And that which is frustrating to some people and puts them in a head spin can turn into the opportunity to just move past it or celebrate it and have a good time and like, this is horrible. Let's celebrate the fact that it's horrible. And in doing so, you know, we laugh a lot. And one more thing I would say, and I think your daughter's probably not of this age yet. Now I'm going to go to my 3-year-old. That ability to play and slow the brain down and be present and in the moment and connect with, in this case, a 3-year-old on his terms, and communicate without, of course, losing your personality or losing your voice, and find that middle ground to get into a sense of play that we would do on an improv stage now with a 3-year-old, I think is a tremendous benefit. And that is one, Jimmy, that when I teach, as I teach so many business people, is a big aha moment to them, that they can go back home to not only their children, their significant others, and learn to be present and learn to engage in a very playful yes and type of way. And that opens up a lot of hearts for a lot of people. And it's a good reminder of really what we all do.
Yeah. And, you know, in the 10 years I've been in psychotherapy, twice a week group therapy, a part of me thinks, and this is a theory, and I'm going to float it out to you. You do not have to yes and this. I'd like your opinion on this. I think for me, I didn't get to play as a child. I had a very kind of repressed household. You didn't share joy. You didn't play around and stuff like that. And I was, in a lot of respects, like a young adult taking care of my parents. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of improvisers probably come from similar households like that. And to me, when I found improv, it's like, oh my God, everything that I was punished for as a kid and in school, I'm now being rewarded for.
I can see that. That wasn't my background. For me, it was more everything that I love in life is now packaged nicely in this thing called improvisation. So I had, I think, a different, you know, a lot of different, I was a troublemaker, really. I got into a fair amount of trouble.
What kind of stuff did you do?
Man. It's usually stuff that was thoughtful and ridiculous. And my four example would be, I took the dean of my high school before I graduated, like several weeks before we graduated, pulled me aside and said he's going to hold my diploma. And if I did anything wrong or if there's anything that was suspicious, he wasn't going to give me my diploma and I wouldn't graduate. And I was thinking about doing something, but I was leaning toward not doing it. And then when he said that, I was like, now I got to do something. That's essentially the challenge. So I lifted a skeleton key from a teacher and made copies of it over a lunch hour. And then broke into the school several times over the course of months or several weeks anyway, often with a buddy of mine. And then went around the city. I went from downtown Illinois, Effingham, went around Effingham and stole toilet paper from dozens of different places so that I didn't want to buy toilet paper from one place because they were like, why are you buying 10 cases of toilet paper? So over the course of weeks, we were just stealing toilet paper from gas stations and restaurants and the school, and I amassed like 300 plus rolls of toilet paper. And then the day before we graduated, which the ceremony was to be held in the gym, we broke into the gym again after casing the place out many, many nights, knowing when janitors were in what rooms. And we toilet papered the gym and launched 300 plus rolls of toilet paper, how many ever feet high those catwalks are above the basketball court. And then and we had, you know, like surgical gloves so we wouldn't get fingerprinted. And then the next morning, there's already an article in the paper, gym vandalized. My dad comes in my room, slams open my door, pulls my sheets off, and he throws the paper. Is this you? Like, I don't know what you're talking about, because the other people I was with, we all swore ourselves to secrecy, of course. But my buddy actually broke into the gym after, because it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I finally went back home. He broke into the gym on his own and took pictures of it. So we actually had physical proof of the quote-unquote vandalism of toilet paper in the gym.
I have so many questions about this. Where did you store 300 rolls of toilet paper? Because I would imagine, I'm getting into the criminal mind that you had back then. Where did you store it? Because you don't want your parents to find them.
Yeah, so we had a little wooded area outside my backyard, not very big. And then I lived in more of the country, so you knew different like barns and stuff like that were less used. And so we put them in bags, separate bags that you know, not 301 giant trash bag, even though we ultimately did put them in just a couple of trash bags to transport them into the gym. And we would just have these like little caches hidden in various spots so that if you found one with like 20 rolls of toilet paper in it, you're really not going to think much of it. You're like, that's weird. But if you find one with 300 rolls, you can think, oh, no, this is really weird. So we would just stash them throughout the city, you know, a little bit in the bedrooms here, closets, a little bit in the garage, and not too many on anybody's house. And the rest of them were just kind of separated in the countryside.
And did you ever get caught?
No. It was our 10-year reunion that my buddy, you know, showed the pictures, and I was like, I think probably the statute of limitations on, you know, harmlessly. I do put air quotes around vandalism because we didn't spray paint it. We didn't do any permanent damage. It was literally toilet paper hanging from the rafters. No, we never got caught.
And I'm curious that your dad immediately saw it in the paper and is like, thought of you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I got into a fair amount of trouble, and that was very much in line with the type of trouble that I would get into. It'd be very thoughtful, well thought out, meticulously planned, you know, intricate, elaborate dumbness.
I'm almost hoping my kid comes up. I hope Betsy comes up with something, because that is very thoughtful and very thought out, you know, and as a kid, it very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, as an 18-year-old, it's like a criminal mastermind of moronic buffoonery.
We've got to wrap this up. This is great. We end the podcast always with the same question. What piece of advice would you give someone starting out in improv comedy today?
Be bold. Study. That's what I would say. Study. You know, go back to what Jimmy and I have both said several times in this. rehearse, practice, go watch people who are better than you, talk to them, be an improv nerd.
And let me just ask you in terms of the studying thing, because today more than ever, we're seeing people study at The Annoyance in Second City at the same time, or I.O. and Comedy Sports, or in New York, they're doing The Pit and The Magnet, or they're doing UCB and The Magnet. What do you tell people in terms of studying, in terms of doing one, doing several? What's your advice on that?
I am a student of improv. So even in Chicago, I started at the Players Workshop. I took through the Improv Olympic. I studied under Mick Napier solely at the Annoyance Theater. I've had tons and tons of great coaches. You know, many of now our peers were my coaches once upon a time. I studied at the Second City. When I moved from Chicago to New York in 2009, even though I was already a very established improviser at 15 plus years in Chicago, playing with great people, you know, Armando and whatnot, I started taking classes again in New York just to learn that different style of art form, learn the short form. I learn the long form. I learn medium forms. When I go to different cities, I talk with them. I'm totally in favor of learning from everybody anywhere. If you hear that they're great, they have a solid reputation, why not? That's my philosophy. I mean, essentially, once again, you do yourself a disservice if you say, I'm only going to learn one single thing and I'm going to focus on that, and that's going to be sacrosanct to me. That's going to be my religion, and everybody else can just bugger off.
Bob Cullen, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd. The book is Getting to Yes and the Art of Business Improv, and it just recently was released.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And I want to thank my guest, my friend, Bob Cullen. Check out his new book, especially if you want to get into this very lucrative. This is where the money is in improv and business and corporations and stuff like that. The book is Getting to Yes and, The Art of Business Improv. Also, I want to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher, who makes me sound so slick and so professional, and Sam Bowers, the director of Improv Nerd, and my wife, Lauren Corrane, who helps me prepare and research for the questions. I guess we could call her like an associate producer. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corrane, and my award-winning classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and intensives and workshops, and to sign up for the Improv Nerd blog, go to my website, jimmycorrane.com. Also, follow us on all sorts of social media. We have a Facebook page, which is Improv Nerd. Like us, because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Follow us on Twitter, which is Improv_Nerd. And, of course, this YouTube channel. You got to subscribe. Please, please, please subscribe. Dan does such a great job. You'll see clips from the live shows and our interviews. We are lucky to be part of Feral Audio. FeralAudio.com has some of the most innovative and hilarious podcasts out there, so go to FeralAudio.com. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you